Today I have Sean Wildermuth. Sean is an author, a speaker, a Microsoft MVP, and an old friend. And while I really like this music, I don't know how to make it go away. That'll do. No nice fade outs for me. How are you, Sean?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am good. I started a new gig, a new job.
Nice.
And working with nice people. So it's a good thing.
Where are you at?
Well, I work for an organization called Cognizant, but they have placed me at a company called Schneider Electronics.
Oh, okay.
And Schneider is huge.
Are they the car software people?
They are mostly hardware.
Oh, okay.
If you've heard of APC, that's like a small part of them.
Oh, okay.
They are in, as I understand it, have major offices in about 6 countries, and then lots of small offices, satellite offices.
Nice.
And their main office for the U.S. is in Andover, and that's where I am, working on mobile applications that control or actually help you set up IoT devices like lights and blinds and so forth.
Awesome. That sounds fun.
It is.
And can you get there through the snow? Because you guys just got walloped, didn't you?
Yeah, we got about 18 inches. That was fun.
Yeah.
And but I have a Subaru all-wheel drive, so, you know, not too bad. That's my dog squeaking in the background. And, you know, thanks for being on the show. We'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Yeah, sounds good. I'll talk to you later.
Before you go, I understand that you are involved with GRPC.
Yeah.
And I confess to you that I don't have a clue about GRPC. So maybe you can start me off with the basics.
Sure. GRPC is a new way of doing web communication. So if you think about, like, we're in sort of the space where everyone's doing everything with REST, and then some people are throwing in GraphQL when they need sort of a searchable endpoint. GraphQL fits into a different space, and I'm talking about it as mostly server-to-server communication, often inside of a data center. So you can imagine, like, microservices talking to each other. It's different in that it's a binary serialization, and it's based on contracts. So some WCF people are also looking at it because it follows sort of the what they're used to a lot better than REST does. This sort of comes into a space where everyone's like, well, why is there a new thing and should we be using it everywhere? Because it actually doesn't do server to web very well. It does server to mobile pretty well, but not server to web very well, just because of the nature of the protocol. You know, JavaScript and it don't interact all that well. And so I think we're headed towards what I'm awkwardly calling polyglot API. And what I mean by that is inside your organization or your app, you may have a handful of different kinds of APIs for different use. I think GRPC fits into that mold really well in these places where you need fast connections when you're dealing with low bandwidth or especially low hardware situations like IoT.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about what it looks like. Is this something that I mean, with REST, it's pretty straightforward. I work within the HTTP commands, and I can do that from virtually any language. I mean, I'm used to doing it in C#.
Correct.
Is that similar with gRPC, or is it language constrained?
It's not language constrained. It's an open sourced protocol. It actually came out of Google initially. And it because it's using contracts, it has these firm contracts. The clients and the servers are usually generated from those contracts. And so this is one of the places where it really is about strong typing to the interface. The communication actually requires HTTP/2. And so that's another reason why this is sort of the bleeding edge of it, is because not a lot of server architecture support HTTP/2 yet, and especially not many client architecture support H2 yet. And so what gRPC does that's different than REST or even GraphQL or some of the other protocols out there is streaming is a natural part of its API. And so if you need to stream results in or out, server to client, client to server, or both, it's a natural part of the language. And so instead of having to come up with schemes to make that work, like we have with SignalR and other technologies, this is a part of the protocol. The protocol is binary encoded, and so the messages are smaller, but that's not a big part of the the benefit to me. The big benefit is because it's based on contracts, deserialization and serialization are a lot quicker. So when you're dealing with low hardware scenarios like IoT, or whether you don't want to commit a lot to them because you're inside of, let's say, a container inside of a data center or inside of a Kubernetes, it works really well because you have this sort of handshake of we both know what this looks like. We're not like in REST, where we're not calling an API and having the documentation base that. And for the typical web scenarios, I don't see gRPC having a big use. But when you get into coordinating services with each other, I see it as a huge.
You were saying that it's particularly good for mobile. As a Xamarin programmer, is that something I should be paying attention to, or is it more targeted at web mobile? Or tell me a little bit more about that.
So I don't think it's necessarily a strong suited to mobile, but because most mobile platforms are based on more type safe languages, you know, if you think about the way that Swift or C Sharp or any of those work, gRPC can work with them a bit better because they can generate those clients for you. Because the nature of the protocol is this streaming protocol that's supported in HTTP/2. That's one of the reasons why the web itself, whether that's mobile web or not, is not a good scenario for it, at least right now. But for some people, they've been using gRPC as a communication between client and server, where the client is a mobile app, whether that's Xamarin or Objective-C or whatever technology you're using. I don't think it's worth the effort for it, to be honest with you. I think REST does a job so well there, unless you have scenarios where streaming is important. So you can imagine if you're building an app with Xamarin where what you wanted to do was get the latest stock price, that being the server being able to just push down the updated stock price to you would be great. But of course, SignalR would do that just as well. So there is a question. A lot of people use SignalR for streaming, and why would you then use gRPC for streaming? The big difference is that SignalR is built for multicast, and gRPC doesn't have that notion of multicast. It's really a point-to-point API.
And you mentioned HTTP/2 twice.
Yes.
So can you talk about what that is? Because HTTP has been the backbone of the web since at least 94.
Correct. And so HTTP/2 is the latest standard. It's supported on a number of servers, but the browsers haven't quite caught up with it, especially older browsers. And it dictates that nothing is, you know, it's a maturation of 1.1 and supports everything that is 1.1, but 2.0 supports some new features. The biggest one is that everything has to be secured and then has a better tunneling protocol to speak with servers. So there's not a ton of stuff in it, but the stuff that's in it is huge to those of us who have had to deal with the serverless or the connectionless communication with the server, where we need connection to a server. And that's what HTTP/2 is supplying for us. The reality is HTTP/2 is sort of a checklist for developers, like, oh, I need this. Do I have it? You're never going to implement it yourself. Some web server is going to implement it for you, and a browser would implement it for you. It's not something that you're necessarily going to start writing to, because it's going to look like it's just infrastructure that you're going to have to rely on.
Okay, so I can expect this to be on Chrome and then on all the other browsers, and then somewhere long after that on IE. Do I have that right?
I'm not sure it'll ever get to IE. Edge supports it. If that's any consolation to you, I'm sure Opera will support it as well. But what you're going to see is HTTP/2 is going to be much more important for non-web stuff. I think it's going to be much more important for server-to-server, server-to-IoT, device-to-IoT, you know, where these streaming protocols are just going to be huge, where we can think about it in a different way. And it isn't a remote procedure call. It isn't like the next com. You're not going to be remoting objects or any, like, it's not to that level. It really is when you need remote procedure calls versus resource-based API. It's a different beast in that way. In something like ASP.NET Core, you could surface REST calls, gRPC calls, GraphQL calls, all from the same server for different kinds of clients that might.
What's the learning curve with gRPC?
The big learning curve is that there's an interface language called protobuffers or protocol buffers, the longer term. And that's a C-like syntax that defines what messages look like and what services look like. And that's where they generate those servers and clients. And then you write using those servers and clients. And once you get your head around protocol buffers, the rest is pretty easy. In fact, for .NET developers, it's easier than REST in some ways because we get back the add service reference sort of experience. In fact, you connect a client to a server by pointing at a protocol buffer file in an add service reference in Visual Studio. So it's super comfortable for people that are, you know, sort of in that space.
You're going to have a course on that for Pluralsight?
There's one out now for using gRPC with ASP.NET Core.
Cool.
Yeah.
I have to go to Pluralsight and look it up.
Yeah. It's a shortish course, but we talk about when to use it, how to use it, and then how to secure it, which is, one of the more important pieces. And because it's just on HTTP, you can secure it using the same methods that you do for REST and such. It uses that same pipeline. It isn't a different thing. It's just a different. So if you're using JWT tokens or JWTs, I hate to say the token twice when I abbreviate it.
You don't say PIN number or ATM machine?
I do, but I hate it. I hate it. I'm embarrassed for myself. Then those would continue to work with gRPC. So it isn't a whole different new infrastructure. It's just another endpoint into a server.
Got it. Okay. I have in my notes that you said, ask me about microservices.
Yeah. So I've been diving, with the investigation with gRPC, I've been diving into microservices more. I'm planning doing some in-person microservices courses for ASP.NET Core in the next 6 months or so. And it's interesting because when microservices came out, as with any new technology, what happens? Everyone says, well, everyone needs to be doing this. This is the best thing ever.
Wait, can you say what microservices
is? Oh, sure. So microservices, that's kind of the problem. Microservices is the idea that instead of sort of deploying a monolith or even silos, that you have a number of services that make up your application that are all disconnected in some way. That way you can deploy the changes to these pieces of your app separately. So instead of having sort of silos of, a monolith would normally be like one giant website that does everything. And then sometimes people will deploy in silos where they're like, okay, the HR department has their app and the sales department has their app. Inventory management has their app. This is really saying that, okay, I have the HR functionality here and I have security functionality here and I have the login here. All is separate deployable pieces, often in the idea of sort of a container, and that they communicate through APIs instead of communicating directly with, let's say, a common data store. So you have these sort of self-contained things that can be tested and deployed separately from having to do an entire application redeployment.
So how is this different from what we were all talking about in the early C# days or even C++ days of getting our heads around the idea of creating objects that have narrowly defined interfaces and that each one has a specific set of responsibilities and they talk to each other through those interfaces. Am I making a fair analogy?
It is, except it's at a server level instead of at a language level. So normally the communication is REST or some other communication. And the difference there is instead of just the objects having their own interfaces, the entire service does, and that includes their data store. So ordinarily we might think of objects in, so let's say C# having an interface and they communicate only through that interface. But then the result of those communications is often commingled in one giant data store that we have the benefit of, doing cross joins to, or to, do warehousing or run AI scripts against. And services want to be different in that sense, so that if a service is best suited to having a SQL store, that it uses that, and that if it's best suited to have a document store, it uses it, or if it's mainly just using Redis as a data store because it's mostly about caching, that it does that. And it all looks really sexy on the front of it, but what I'm reading about and playing with now is that the coordination of getting all these services working has a cost, and unless you have a huge payback from that cost, you need to be a little cautious. And so in some ways, I'm really happy that this is when I'm getting involved in it instead of the early rah-rah stage. Yeah, that there's been some maturity around, oh, we made everything a microservice and we forgot we only had 12 customers. Because it does well, add a lot of complexity.
When all you have is a hammer.
Yes.
Okay, that was great. Let me tell you what I know about .NET Core.
Sure.
I know that I need .NET Core 3 in order to have C# 8 in Visual Studio.
That is
the sum total of my knowledge. And 3.1 just came out.
Correct.
So can you talk a little bit about .NET Core 3.1?
Sure. Core 3.1 was really envisioned as the long-term supported version. 3.0, in some ways, was a polished release candidate, because they always knew that about 2 months later, or maybe it was 3 months later, that they were going to release this 3.1. And for the most part, the difference between 3.1 and 3.0 is that they were able to finish a lot more of Blazor. It has a couple of other changes and fixes, but for the most part, the only people that it's super important to are either people who are doing Blazor or people who will only deploy on long-term supported versions of .NET Core, because 3.0 didn't have that on purpose, because they knew 3.1 was coming, you know, fairly quickly.
All right. Before we talk about your movie, let's talk about Blazor. I know you're a big fan. Can you talk about what it is and why you love it so much?
I love Blazor. Just ask me, you know, how much I love Blazor. Blazor is an interesting thing to me, and I'm still a little confused by their strategy between a server and a client part of Blazor, because the Blazor that's released now is really server components that you can write that communicate through SignalR to JavaScript on the client. And client Blazor, which they're still working on, is going to be C# compiled to WebAssembly that works in the browser. And I'm glad they're holding off on that piece, because it's still as sexy as it is, especially for people who don't want to get their who don't want to invest in JavaScript or TypeScript. It involves a lot of code running in the browser. You really need a version of the .NET framework compiled to WebAssembly running in the browser. And we've tried this a few times before. When I say us, I mean Microsoft. I don't work for them. I like to talk about it in those terms.
Suffer with them.
Yeah. Silverlight. There was WebForms controls in the browser before that. I mean, this is something that they've been trying for a long time. And I'm not opposed to it. I just don't think it's for everyone. I had some conversations with Microsoft people a few months ago that weren't on the Blazor team. So it's not like this is the manifesto of the Blazor team. But what I heard sort of confirmed my own assumption, is that Blazor is for web form developers, people who do not, you know, after the, you know, the 20 years since web forms, still don't want to move into client side development. They need a solution for getting off of web forms into more, you know, rich web development, but they're not willing to leave C#. And WebBlazor does that. It does that in some ways really interestingly and well, but it's not going to be web development. You're never going to get, you know, people that are doing Node and Angular to go, oh, well, Blazor is a way better solution. It just isn't the so if you can, you really, the competitor for Blazor isn't, if you want to think about where Blazor fits, Angular, Vue and React are Blazor competitors, not you know, Java and Ruby and Rails. Like, it's much more about getting these rich clients or being able to do more interesting things in the client than it is anything else. And if you're morally opposed or just don't like or want to learn JavaScript, it's a solution that works. And as far as some people have said, it works well. I've been in JavaScript too long to feel like it doesn't, that it's not trying to hide the details, which is what we tried to do with web forms, right? Web forms was,
yeah,
I don't want to teach you how the web works, and I just want you to be able to write forms. And I feel like this is a continuation of that more than a revolution in the way we're building applications.
Right. Originally, mm-hmm, I was hearing it as web development for C# developers.
Yeah.
But
I think that's true. I think we're using different phrases for the same idea. The reality for me is that there is this, there's a difference of opinion about whether WebAssembly is going to change everything or not. And as many of your readers or listeners probably know, I'm wrong way more than I. So I'm happy to find out later that I'm wrong. But WebAssembly feels to me like a component vendor tool, not a web developer tool.
Again, please define that one as well.
Yeah. So I think the WebAssembly would be great for components that are being used in the web by web developers to be able to do very interesting and intricate things. But I don't think, writing websites in Rust and C++ just because they can be compiled to WebAssembly makes a whole lot of sense. I think TypeScript and JavaScript are still going to exist for most web development. But I really see WebAssembly as a way like, oh, there are things that JavaScript does really bad that would be nice to have a better technology to do, like memory allocation. JavaScript is bad at like looking through arrays, deserializing binary, like a bunch of these things. WebAssembly will be a whole lot better than it. But concatenating strings and spitting out anchor tags, I just don't see the benefit of having WebAssembly in the browser do that versus JavaScript or just Get, you know?
Yep, great. Now let's turn to your movie.
Yes.
Which last we spoke was, I believe, was getting ready to be seen by some early viewers. Is that
yes,
right?
We did a couple of test screenings and got a lot of good feedback from them. We actually cut out about 20 minutes of the movie in reaction to those test screenings.
It was all me that you cut. Playful.
No, you're still in there. You still made the cut.
Great.
And we've done some more edits since then. And then we did what they call picture lock, which is you can't make any more edit because then it gets handed over to the sound people. So we have Peggy Johnson, who's worked on some other high profile movies like Benjamin Button, probably the one that people know most. She's doing the soundtrack for the movie. And we have our sound engineer doing the final mix for the movie. Those are the last two things to do before we can actually get it to be seen. So that's supposed to be done by the end of the year or by the 11th of January at the absolute latest. That's sort of our drop dead deadline, and which means I can't do anything else. I just have to wait 2 months while they do their magic, and that's not a comfortable place.
And what happens after January 11th?
We start submitting it to film festivals, and we'll spend 2020 trying to get it sold, finding a sales agent to get it on a Disney Plus and Netflix, Amazon, one of those things. We're not really going to take it to theaters because that's not where most documentaries are seen unless they're really, really general. So, the goal is to get it there. Worst case, we have an avenue to get it onto Amazon Prime. That's sort of our fallback if we can't get someone to actually buy it. But hopefully that won't be the case. Hopefully we'll get someone to buy it and put a little marketing money into making sure people know it exists. And then I've already, started work on another documentary, but that's a couple of years out.
Well, this is so exciting. Yeah. So can you say anything about your next work?
No, I don't want to talk about it yet, but it's not around technology.
Okay.
Yeah, it's around more of a personal subject. And when I'm ready to share, I'll talk about it. But it's not
so
a technology.
Cute cats. And
yes, it's going to be dogs. About mostly cats and how their paws work.
Okay. Well, I'm wish you a tremendous amount of luck, and B, really want to hear when this gets to the festivals and
sure
how it's received, because from what I've seen of it, it's going to be, I think, have a really wide interest. How do you say that in English? There's going to be a lot of people who are interested in it.
I hope so. I did want to point people to, we've done two short films from stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, stuff that just didn't fit well into the movie. And you can see those now on YouTube. And let me get you an URL to put out, but they're going to be on.
Yeah, we'll put it on the page.
Yeah. But one of them is about work-life balance. And then another one is about sort of the first computer experience. And we put those out maybe a month ago. And we're probably going to do two more as we get closer to the release of the movie. But it's a little series called From the Cutting Room Floor of Hello World. If you search for that, you'll find
it. Okay. It's a clever title.
It's a little long. But it is what it is. So thanks so much for having me on the show.
This is great, Sean. I really, really appreciate it.
And are we going to get outro music?
Oh, wait. Yeah. Hold on. No, even better. I've got the perfect thing to end. How's that?
I'm still mourning from from the last year's baseball. I'm not sure that was a... Thanks for bringing up all my pain.
I'm sorry. Here, we'll go with this then. So, have a great night.
I will.
And thank you so much.
Great. We'll talk again soon.
Okay.